Nick, thank you so much. It is absolutely a pleasure to be back. And when I say be back, I've been teaching classes to CPAs since 1984. And it's been a little while since I've done this. And it is one of the things I've always enjoyed the most because my hope is this information will go to your ears and then to the ears of others. So I gave a group a whole bunch of different topics that they could choose from, and this is the one they chose. I'm so happy they did because, in fact, this question of should you manage your investments yourself or hire a professional? Most people, especially young people, have really no idea what that means over a lifetime. And my job since I retired in 2012, just a sec here now. I've got to move this. There we go. I retired in 2012 and set up the Merriman Financial Education Foundation. And our job is to provide the tools and the information so that individuals can make these investment choices, so that you can take the responsibility. I've been around this business since the mid-60s, 1960s. And what I know is back then, investing was not very easy. It was expensive. It wasn't well defined. It wasn't very well diversified. And today, with index funds and ETFs and low expenses and all the things, target date funds, I'll spend a little bit talking about each one of these. But today, it is so blooming easy to be an investor. And the key is how you should take advantage of that efficiency that you have available to you today. And that is the mission of our work, is help people go through that. Now, there we go. It's easy. And I said it that it's more efficient. Well, Warren Buffett said it beautifully. He said, when he was talking about to be a success in life, he said, you only have to do a very, very few things right, as long as you don't do too many things wrong. And I really agree with that statement when it comes to investing, because truly, to be a successful investor, there are about a dozen, maybe at the most 20 investment decisions. I'm not talking about financial planning. I'm not talking about estate planning. I'm not talking about taxes. I'm just talking about the simple process of putting together a properly diversified portfolio. It is so simple, and we've got a free PDF if people are interested. And the book is entitled "We're Talking Millions: 12 Simple Ways to Supercharge Your Portfolio, Your Retirement." So I'm hoping that I'll hit the main ones for you to know about, and I'm sure most of them you will. We have a problem today with trust. We don't trust Congress. We don't trust the information on the internet. Some people don't trust the press. Corporations certainly are questioned about the terms of trust. And what about Wall Street? I mean, this is where most of the investing goes on. And yet, the reality is that most people don't really trust what comes out of Wall Street. And my hope is that we will trust the process if we follow the math, that investing based on following the math is really quite simple. Let me show you an example. And this is without the market. This is not about what the market's going to do for you. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But I just want to talk about the math of the difference of very small amounts of return. And in this particular case, what we have is we have a table here that you'll notice scenario one, the investor makes 8% a year during the accumulation period for 40 years, having invested $6,000 a year, a total of $240,000, and then they retire. And for the next 30 years, they make 6% a year, and they take out 4% a year to live on. Now, this is important because here's how I measure the return of your investments. If you have invested $240,000 the first of each year, $6,000, and you had an 8% compound rate of return, that turned into about $1.7 million. If, on the other hand, you got an 8.5% return, a half a percent more, you would have $1.9 million. Now, we can talk about where that half a percent might come from, but I want you to see the importance. Right here, you've already got over a $200,000 advantage, but there's more. When we look at what you took out of that portfolio, taking out 6% during the distribution period, I'm sorry, taking out 4%, but making 6%, that total withdrawal distribution number would be about $2.6 million. On the other hand, if you did it making an extra half a percent, making 6.5 instead of 6, it would be $3.2 million. But that's not the end either, because then we pass on and we leave whatever's left over to others, children, charities, whatever it might be. In the case of the first scenario, you would leave at age 95, basically $2.8 million. If you take scenario two, it would be $3.7 million. The outcome of that extra half a percent over a lifetime is basically the difference between the $5.5 million and the $7 million that you had between the distributions and what you left to others, or an advantage of $1.5 million. So if we can just find a half a percent, or in the case of hiring an advisor, oftentimes that advisor charges 1%. So what if we didn't pay that 1%? And so what if, for example, instead of an 8% return and an 8.5, let's say the difference is between 8 and 9% instead of 8 and 8.5. In a way, that is the implication of hiring somebody and paying them 1% a year to get that investment process done for you. Now, what does that do? What is the implication of that? Well, the implication is now that instead of making 5.5%, you're going to make, 5.5 million, you're going to make almost 9 million because of that 1% difference. And that is about a difference of around $3.5 million. And here's the reality, that many of you are going to be able to save and you're going to get a match. So you put in 6 and they put in some, and maybe you're saving 9,000 a year instead of 6. And maybe you're putting away 10% of your salary and it's not going to be a $6,000 a year investment. It's going to be a $10,000 a year investment. So these numbers are really understating the likely reality of certainly your life as a CPA. So this looks to me like the real cost of an advisor is about $3.5 million, given a relatively low amount of savings. But there's more. And when I say there's more, I'm saying that there is more in what you can do. You see, some people forget that the investor has a partnership. The partnership is between the investor and, let's call it, the stock market. And the stock market has to do its work, whatever it does. But it does its work whether you put $100 to work or $1,000 to work. It's still going to do that same work. So there are advantages at your end if you do a little more work in the saving part of the process. So if you were to save more, so if instead of putting away $6,000, you put away $6,000 plus 3% every year. So the second year, you would give out, you would put aside over $6,000, and every year a little more, 3%. By the way, that's sounding like a way to protect against the impact of inflation, doesn't it? So what does that mean? Same set of circumstances, same stock market or bond market, nothing changed there. Well, now you're up by being able to make 9% instead of the and 7%. You are up now by saving that extra 3%, or, by the way, going from 240 up to 452. All right, you saved about another $200,000, and you have another $3.5 million in the kitty that you took in distributions and that you left to others. So there are things you can do. It isn't all up to Mr. Market, as Benjamin Graham named the market. It's also up to you. And it's also up to you as when you start. Because even the decision to start a few years sooner has a huge impact later in your life. So if you started at 25 or you started at age 30, okay, and so you had in one case 40 years of accumulation, in the other you had 35 years of accumulation. What does that extra 5 years of early income give to you over this entire period? Well, it turns out to be about an extra $4.7 million. So there's another thing that you can take responsibility for. It's not up to an advisor. It's not up to the stock market to make this additional money. It's really up to you. And so in the early years, in the partnership with you and your investments, you truly are the key player. You're the important partner. The market is relatively minor, the return there compared to you getting that money in there and working for you. And that's something, if you don't have an advisor, you're going to have to maintain this discipline on your own. That's part of the reason you get to make an extra $3.5 million, because you concluded that you can maintain that discipline on your own. And then if you're going to be your own advisor, one of the big decisions you have to make is, am I going to put my money in stocks or am I going to put it in bonds? Now, we are told that something like almost 25% of millennials say no way to stocks. Not going to have any of those stocks in the portfolio. That's just gambling as far as we're concerned. We want bonds where things are secure. But we need definitely need to understand what the implication is to that. Because here's the return of bonds, government bonds, going back to 1928. The compound rate of return of intermediate bonds, around 5%, okay? And that would turn a $100 investment 94 years ago into $10,000. And you might not think a 94-year investment is actually a legitimate thing to think in terms of. But I will tell you, every time we get another grandchild in our family, money goes into an account that starts right now building, and we've just written about this recently. I write an article every couple of weeks for Market Watch, or you can get them at our website, paulmerriman.com. But I talked about making this investment on behalf of my new granddaughter, and that the money is being put aside for the express purpose of funding a Roth IRA. And depending on how well that account does, it could fund the Roth IRA for most of her life. I mean, there's some amazing things we can do for a newborn child. Anyway, right now I want to focus on this $100 growing to $10,000 over that period of time. On the other hand, if we look at equities, whether we talk about the S&P 500, an asset class we call large cap blend, we look at all the companies that are large of a certain size, and we look at some are growth, some are value, some are the really hot dogs, the great companies that are forging in all the new exciting industries, and then you've got the old time earners and the companies that have been around paying dividends. They're all in one big portfolio called the S&P 500. That asset class has compounded at about 10% a year. That $100 has grown to be worth over $900,000, not $10,000, $900,000. So do you think I'm going to put my grandchild's money for the long term into bonds, or do I want to put it into stocks? Well, I don't, there's a lot of stocks I don't want it to go in, but I can tell you, I want it to be diversified, and I like it to be in a lot. And by the way, this is the decision you're going to have to make, but you also could have it in what they call the large cap value asset class. That particular asset class, these are large companies out of favor, not the hot dogs. Compound rate of return historically 11.2. Why? Because they're more risky. At least they're perceived to be more risky at the time that they are out of favor. And then we have small companies that are growth and value, and small companies that are purely value. Those are legitimate asset classes. In a few minutes, I'm going to show you this wonderful quilt chart. And if you've never seen a quilt chart, I think you're gonna love it. I hope you do, because it is one of the best learning tools I've ever seen. But here's what I know. I know that the small cap value asset class has compounded at 13.4%. And that $100 is worth today, well, of course, that's the end of 2021. It was worth $13 million. And oh, for what it's worth, of all the asset classes in 2022, small cap value has been the most productive asset class. More on that in a few minutes. Anyway, you can see why stocks represent, from everything we know about the past, one of the best places to put money for the long term, which is what we're talking about for your retirement. One stock versus many. Now, I know that most, particularly young people, believe that if you really want to make a lot of money, you got to take the time to find the great companies, the great growth companies of the future. And by the way, by the time you find the great growth companies of the future, a whole bunch of other people have found them as well. And it's not unusual for them to be selling for 40, 50, 100 times earnings versus the not exciting companies that are not viewed as the best companies for the future, typically sell around, let's say, 10 to 15 times earnings. So one stock can look like a winner, but all of the academic research tells us that many stocks actually has a higher probability of making you a better return than a few. And by the way, 99% of us are going to be able to own many stocks by buying mutual funds. And I know that you know what mutual funds are, how they operate. I'm going to focus on a few that are my favorite kind of mutual funds in the next few minutes, the ones I think you'll do the best with over the long term, but I truly believe, and so does Dr. Bessembinder. Dr. Bessembinder did a study entitled, "Do Stocks Outperform Treasury Bills?" out of the Arizona State University. And he did it along with some other folks. And here is what they found. And I just love the truth and the implications of that truth. They found that looking at all of the companies, the public companies, going back to 1928 through 2016, that while the compound rate of return was about 10%, that it was only 4% of the companies, 4% that represented the majority of that return, that gave it that 10% return, because the other 96% of the companies averaged 3%, many of them going out of business. And even in my lifetime, many huge companies have gone out of business. It is not unusual. But then, of course, a lot of small companies go out of business as well. But the bottom line is, the academics believe that you are likely to get the return of the market that you'd like to get in most cases by simply owning all of the companies, in essence. This one is a no-brainer. Every academic, and by the way, as far as I'm concerned, the sources of information I trust, and I would like you to trust, remember I said to follow the math? Well, where I find the math more interesting is not out of Wall Street, because they do seem to have just a couple of conflicts of interest along the way. And so often the things they put their stamp of approval on turn out to be really bad for people. Now, there's also what we call Main Street. Main Street would be your neighbor or a friend at the office or somebody that talks a good story and seems to understand the process of investing. Often they don't. And when they do tell you the stories about how well they did, which might, you know, pique your interest a little bit, they don't tell you about the stuff that didn't work out. I mean, human nature would say that would be likely. So the best source of information I know is what we call University Street, the academic community. And the academic community says, above all other kinds of variables you could look at, that the one variable that is constant is lower expenses lead to higher returns. Lower expenses lead to higher returns. Now, be careful, because one could say, well, I can buy a bond fund for 0.1% a year, and I can buy a stock fund for 0.2% a year. Wouldn't I be better in the bond fund because the fee is lower? No, that's not the message they want you to get. The message the academics want you to get is that when you look at a bunch of mutual funds here, that's what we're talking about, that are in the same asset class. For example, there are S&P 500 mutual funds that have an expense ratio of zero. They have no management expense. They have no administrative expense. It's basically on the house. It is meant to be a come on to get money into that mutual fund family that does it. It's Fidelity, by the way. On the other hand, there are mutual funds that replicate the S&P 500, but charge a half to 1%. And you're not getting anything extra for it. What you're getting almost guaranteed is a return that is going to be about a half to 1% lower. So expenses are really important within each asset class. Not all asset classes are exactly the same. Now, here's a huge fork in the road. I mean, you can cut through so many important choices if you will just make this choice right. And that is the choice buying actively managed funds or passively managed index funds. Now, I grew up in a time when virtually everything was actively managed. Why? Because when I started in the business in the mid-60s, there were no index funds. Everybody was managing money with the promise, we're going to try to beat the market. We're going to try to make you more money than those people our competition over there are making. Well, what happened is John Bogle came along in the mid-70s and started the first index fund that did not try to beat the market. It did not try to beat the market in any single way. It simply tried to be the market as efficiently as it could. So nobody had to figure out the best companies. You didn't have to hire anybody special to manage that fund theoretically. And you could charge very little. And when I talk about that one that charges zero, it's an index fund. And if you go to a Vanguard, you, depending on the size of your account, you can buy an index fund for 0.03% a year. So index funds are super, super cheap, and they are massively diversified. My wife and I own 10, basically what we would call index funds. Between those 10 index funds, we have over 12,000 different companies, some big and small and REITs and emerging markets and U.S. and international and all these different kinds, but they are all represented through index funds. And why do I believe that is the right thing? When you're going to be your own manager and you're going to take the responsibility of deciding what you own in your portfolio, remember, you're getting the big $3 to $5 million payoff for doing this right. What you would know is a study that is updated every 6 months by Standard & Poor's. It's called the SPIVA report. The SPIVA report looks back 1, 3, 5, 10, 15, and 20 years. And let's go out 20 years because we're thinking about it, at least 20 years, more than likely. What do they track? They track the performance of all of the mutual funds. And they look to see how many mutual funds in each individual asset class, the large companies, well, the large growth companies, the large blend mutual funds, the large value mutual fund. They look at them all. And the question is this. How many of them are able to do better than just buying the benchmark, just being the market rather than trying to beat the market? And it's about 1 out of 10 is able to do better than just being in an index fund. Now, it takes all of the fun out of the process. It takes all of the bragging rights. The only bragging rights you'd really have is that you're really smart and you know what the right thing to do based on following the math. By the way, all of those people who are trying to beat the market, they're legitimately trying to beat the market. They know you should have your money in an index fund and that the likelihood of them beating the market is very low. But let's face it, we still have lotteries. People still think people are going to win. How many times have you ever bought a lottery ticket? And after you buy the lottery ticket, you start thinking about how you're going to spend this money that is about a 300 million to 1 probability that you're going to win. But your mind still goes there. And people hope that the manager that recently outproduced the market will outproduce it again. Unfortunately, there is no evidence that that is the way it works. So I say, from everything I know, that if you are the boss in managing your portfolio, the smart thing to do, not just low expenses, not just massive diversification, but I think doing it through index funds is really a smart thing to do. Now, I want to go back. It's a little different table. I just want you to see this, because that other table that I showed you, oh, God, there was a lot of volatility. I mean, with the S&P 500, you could have had a year that you lost 43%. But when we look out 40 years, remember, you're the boss of your portfolio. You're the manager. You're not looking to make a home run in the next year. As a matter of fact, you become realistic about the losses that you might have to sustain, because you, as the manager yourself, the do-it-yourself manager, you've taken the time, and I'm going to show you exactly what I think you need to learn, but you've taken the time to see what the bad times look like, how often they happen, how big they are, what happens after the decline. You know all that stuff because you've looked at the numbers. You've followed the math. But look at the compound rate of return of the S&P 500. There are 55 40-year periods. The best 40-year period was a compound rate of return of 12.5. The worst was 8.9. The average was 11. And over the last 52 years, the return for the S&P 500, 11. For the other asset classes, the returns are much higher. 13.5 for large cap value, 13.7, not much difference there for small cap blend, and 16.2 for small cap value. Will the S&P 500 make 11 in the future? I don't know. I know since 2000, the S&P 500 has compounded at about 7%. Does that mean that for the rest of eternity, that it's going to be 7%, going to be 10 or 11? I don't know, but we do know that it should be better than bonds. We can hope for the best, prepare for the worst. I also notice here, small cap value, that 16%, I'll tell you why I don't believe that's going to happen. Doesn't mean that it might not. But I think too many people know about it today. What I think about it, I think in terms of 12%, that it would get a likely 2% premium, maybe 3% premium over the S&P 500. For the last 52 years, it's about a 3% premium. Not a 5% premium. So, small cap did better than large. Okay, let's put some in the portfolio. I don't mean you have to put it all in, but I think you should have some. I don't care if you're retired. I think you have some. My wife and I have half of our money in equities. Half of the money's in small, half the money's in large. Okay, and that's because we've looked at the numbers of the 50-50. I'm going to show you in a few minutes. But I want you to go beyond just having small as an extra holding. I'd like you to also, I'd like you to add value. You don't get much value in the S&P 500. And if you happen to own the total market index, which has almost exactly the same return as the S&P 500 for the last 90 plus years, if you were to, in fact, put that money, the total market would have the same return as the S&P 500. So the amount of value that you get in that equity portfolio of a total market or the S&P 500, it's not great. I want you to add some more. I'm going to show you exactly how much I think you could legitimately add without doing anything dumb. As a matter of fact, I'm going to show you how you're actually going to make more money with less risk. Now, if I'm going to do my job, and for 30 years in building the Merriman Wealth Management Company, basically what I was a teacher. And I tried my best to show people how to do it on their own. I'm pretty smart about this because I've been on a diet since the fifth grade. And I know that I've yet to conquer the challenges, the emotional challenges of dieting. And I believed that probably if you showed people exactly what they should do, that many people would not be willing to do it. But they would know more what to expect if they would just learn these things that we have tables for. In fact, at our site, paulmerriman.com, we have over 160 tables of numbers. These are the tables of numbers that advisors have. They know how to sort through them. They know all this. There's no secret about this stuff. I've been putting these tables together for, what, almost 30 years now. So here's what I know. I know that you have choices. In this particular case, I don't expect you to see the numbers and be able to read them. That's not what I'm concerned about right now. I just want you to know what we're trying to do for you. This is a page of numbers devoted to the S&P 500 as the equity class. And as the equity class, what we want you to see is the 100% equity is the S&P 500. You can see 1 year at a time. On the other hand, you may not want to be all equities. What if you decided you wanted to have some money in bonds? All right, we have a column of bonds from 1970 through 2021. It's a conservative strategy with bonds, and we tell you exactly what bond funds that we think you should use. But the bottom line is it's all governments and it's short to intermediate term. No long-term bonds. They're much higher risk day-to-day, year-to-year than the intermediate to short term. Now, in between, all in bonds and all in stocks may be who you are. For my wife and myself, I mentioned, we are 50-50. We are 50% in stocks and 50% in bonds. So now I can look here at each year, what it would have been like as an investor for 52 years. But more importantly, at the end of the day, because, you know, we always talk about the bottom line, here's the bottom line. The bottom line is, this is the S&P 500 equity. The compound rate of return was 11. And if you had the bonds at 7, but you put 10% in equities and 90% bonds, it's 7.6%. You made an extra half of 1% by adding 10% in bonds. If you added another 10% in bonds, you make 8.1. You make another half a percent. You see how easy it is to make an extra half of 1%? And I'm not talking about having to take a lot of extra risk. And we show you the risk. We show you the worst 12 months. We show you the worst drawdown. That's a loss from peak to bottom before you come back up to that peak. You had to sit in that thing if you were in the S&P 500 and go down 51% along the way. But with 50-50, the loss was 25%. And every one of the strategies that we propose you consider, and we've got 9 of them, I'm not going to cover all 9 of them right now, but every one of them has a fine-tuning table. In fact, we have one that's for all small cap value. And again, you have the table that shows, okay, instead of going from 7 to 14, I mean to 11, it goes from 7 to 14. And by the way, if you added 10% small cap value to 90% bonds, you'd pick up about 0.9%. Because it made the small cap value made more money, it means as you add the equity, you're going to make more. Well, you know, there's more risk in small cap equity. Look at here, down 61% was the worst drawdown. And I don't know what your limits are, but if you're a do-it-yourself investor, it's up to you to know what those likely losses are. Because I mean, at 79, what happens to the rest of me in my life is a pretty much random event. But if you're in your 40s or your 30s or your 20s, you're going to live through losses like this at some point. I'm not going to guarantee it, but I'll bet you I just won't be here to pay the bet, all right? Okay, but what if you put the two of them together? See, now we're talking about diversification. We're talking about diversification, and we're gonna split the S&P 500 and the equity between the S&P 500 and small cap value. So what does that mean? What does that mean in terms of how it looks when we start looking at the fine print down here at the bottom? Well, what that means is that the combination of those two compounded at 12.7%, not 14, not 11, okay? And that's what you would expect, somewhere in between. And that the 50-50 portfolio compounded at 10.3 and had about the same, remember it was about a 25% worse drawdown, now it's 27.7. And what we're looking for is some sort of combination that gives you a peace of mind. That's the key. It's about trying to get a better rate of return, trying to take less risk, and trying to find something that you can trust for the long term. So here, and by the way, I am really hoping that if you find this of interest, that you'll watch it again. We're gonna archive it on our website, on our YouTube page. And Nick said that they are going to eventually archive this on, I believe, your YouTube page. But I'm hoping that you'll find this interesting enough to come back and revisit these numbers or dig into the numbers on our website. But you can compare each one of these so easily. All right, let's give you a little rest from the numbers. I've got more numbers, but I'm going to let you rest here for a few minutes. Big decision. Do you hold on to your money waiting for that good opportunity to invest it? Or do you put money in every month and dollar cost average? Well, there are a few guarantees in this business. And one of those guarantees is that when you dollar cost average into a mutual fund that's diversified so that it is going to go up over the long term. See, with individual stocks, that might not be true. But you dollar cost average, and when you put in $100 a month, that $100 buys more shares when the market is down and fewer shares when the market is up. It guarantees you do something that is more difficult than a lot of people know unless they've got this on automatic. Because when the market is in decline, it becomes harder to be happy to invest. Not this again. I'm going to lose more money. I could just hear the self-talk. But the idea is stay the course. Dollar cost, that's what a 401k, it's set up automatically to do that. Buy and hold versus market timing. Everybody I know in the business, every academic I know, will tell you that you are better off simply buying and holding. Don't try to second guess. I can't tell you how many people I've talked to since March of 2009 that sold out in that early part of 2009. They've had it. They thought the market was going to nothing. They were going to lose everything. Or the market was going to go down a whole lot more and they were going to be smart and get back in. And many of those people, believe it or not, are still sitting in the cash that they had because they got out of the market. it is important to have the right amount of fixed income in your portfolio to limit the losses you're going to expose yourself to with your portfolio. But to try to defend against the bad times by being a market timer, I will tell you, I know market timing. I've been studying market timing since 1966. It's a fascinating topic, but I can also tell you, I have met very few people who are able to maintain the discipline of market timing. Buy and hold, just keep your hands off it. I mean, it's easy to know what you're not supposed to do. With market timing, it starts to become intuitive. It sounds right to get out. As a matter of fact, not only are you feeling that way, but you've been listening to Jim Cramer, or you've been listening to somebody else talking about the market and how it's going to hell. Well, those people don't know anything more about the future than you do. But the more they talk and the louder they talk, the more money they make. But they don't make it in the market, okay? They make it off of you. This one's easy. Well, it's mostly easy. You're going to have to make the decision how much you put in taxable, how much in tax-free. Now, there could be a lot of debates about the decisions you'd make around that. Would you accumulate a pool of money that you're going to live on and let your tax deferred or other money continue to compound and without having to access it early on? There's some planning that could go on. And by the way, I am not anti-planning. I am not anti-tax experts and anti-estate planning experts and anti-planning experts. What I'm trying to help people believe is that to be a tax expert, to be an estate planning expert, to be an expert in planning, you know, there's a lot of study to do that. But to be an expert on investing, It's the easiest job I could possibly think of. Because if you spend a week, 40 hours dedicated to just learning how to do this, there's hardly anything more to learn. Now, whether you use the 401k Roth or the regular 401k or the Roth IRA or the HSA or taxable, some of those are planning decisions. They're not really investing decisions. I will say this. I'm a huge fan of the Roth, not because it always makes tax sense, but when I first came into this industry back in the mid-60s, the marginal tax rate the year before I came in was 90%. When I came in, it was 70%. And I don't have any reason to think it won't be there again. And oh, by the way, people still worked hard. I mean, it's interesting because you believe that if you ever taxed people at the 70% rate, everybody would go home. No, people don't go home. They keep doing what they're doing. Oh, they complained, of course. But we complain if it's 35%, don't we? Huh? Target date funds. I've got a whole piece that I think I did for the Washington Society of CPAs on target date funds, America's number one retirement investment. I think target date funds are absolutely amazing, because the target date fund, if you're not gonna hire somebody to manage money for you, if you're not gonna do it yourself and make the decisions, the target date fund asks you one question. When do you expect to retire? Let's say it's 2065. Great. Put your money into the 2065 target date fund. They will have it almost all in equities today. By the time you're 50, you're 55 or 60, you'll have more fixed income in the portfolio. At my age, they would have me 70% in fixed income and 30% in equities. But target date funds are an amazing product. They are really the answer for people who just don't want to deal with it. And Wharton did a study where they looked at the returns of people who owned target date funds versus those that didn't, and they found an expected return difference of 2.3% a year. And they looked at 1.2 million retirement accounts. And that's because people on their own, generally, they aren't doing the right thing. So I would make one recommendation about target date funds. If you read our book, We're Talking Millions, the last half of the book is about target date funds. It does suggest if you want to do better than a target date fund, and if you're putting away 10% a year into your target date fund, put 9% into the target date fund. Put the other half a percent, 1% in the small cap value fund. Ah, here's that quilt chart I was talking about. When I first saw this, what I asked Daryl Balls is our director of analytics. He donates about 200 hours a year or more, helping us provide the people who follow our work. By the way, I do not get any compensation for the work that I do. Neither does Daryl, neither does Chris Pedersen, who's our director of research. We are only trying to help you do better. And we are really hoping you'll tell other people how to do it as well. I asked Daryl, I said, I want to figure out a way to help people understand how different asset classes perform. And so this is the same stuff I was talking about before, 1 year at a time since 1928. For the S&P 500, for large cap value. By the way, the S&P 500 is green. Large cap value is kind of a brownish color. And then there's kind of a pinkish color that is a small cap blend. And then the electric blue is small cap value. And the purple is the four fund strategy. I love the tail this quilt chart tells me. I can look and I can see the green. I can see the green at the top and then at the bottom. I can see the green at the bottom for 5, 6, 7 years in a row. I don't see it at the top very often, 5, 6, 7 years in a row. And that's because it's supposed to be at the bottom. Remember, it is the least productive of those asset classes, but not 1 year at a time. It is often at the top. And blue, the small cap value, is supposed to be at the top. And it is at the top a lot. About half of the time. And I'm sorry, I didn't hang up that phone. And that phone is across the room. All right. So here is what I know about this table. What really gets my attention is when I look at that purple. That purple is the four fund strategy. That purple is in the middle of those years in almost, not every case, but in most cases. And so what I want you to notice is that not only did it have less volatility than the S&P 500, but when we look at the compound rate of return of the four fund strategy compared to the S&P 500, what we see is, and we can see it right down here. In fact, let me go to the next table here. Here we have the compound rate of return of the four fund strategy from 1928 to 2021. 12%. For the S&P 500, 10.2%. In 51% of the years, the S&P 500 was the worst performer. In 38% of the years, it was the best performer. And the two-fund strategy was never the best. The two-fund strategy was never the worst. It was always somewhere here in the middle. Small cap value, 48% of the time was in first place. 33% of the time, it was in last place in terms of its ordinal rank. And by the way, if you wanted to make more, You could just go to the two fund strategy. The two fund strategy made 12.2% over that entire period. The all value, 12.5%. You could even theoretically, you could have your IRA in the four fund strategy. You could have your spouse's IRA in the two fund strategy. You could have another one all in the S&P 500. Of course, you're going to have to figure how much you need to have in fixed income. I love those tables. And here's another set of tables, and I've got about 5 minutes. I really think this is where you're going to see some information that will help you make the decision. These are the nine different strategies that we discuss at length. We have distribution tables. We have fixed distribution, variable distributions, accumulation tables. We have the fine-tuning tables. We have all these ways you can turn these different strategies inside out. And so here it tells you how much in each of these asset classes, which includes some international asset classes as well as REITs. So here's the table that I just think is worthwhile you spending some time. You've got the PDF of it. Take a look at this. Daryl put this one together too. Again, I wanted to give people in a one table with a lot of numbers the information that that they really need. And here's what we've got. We've got all of these different strategies looked at. How did they do one decade at a time? So you can see that from 1970, the S&P 500 had a bad decade from 70 to 79. It only compounded at 5.8. As a matter of fact, it was even worse from 2000 to 2009. But if you had the 10 fund strategy, you compounded at 12.3 over the whole period. But in that period from 1970 to 79, the 10 fund strategy compounded at 13.3. In fact, the worst 10 years was from 2000 to 2009. So you can compare all of those strategies. Then you can compare, how did they do in the good times? How many up years did they have? What was the sum of all of the up years? And you could look, for example, at the S&P 500, 42 profitable years, and the sum was 787% in the good times, not in the bad. But look at the two fund strategy. It had 41 positive years. It had one more losing year. The average return was higher, but the total, the sum of all the profitable years, 871%. Look at this. If we look at the down years, the 10 years the S&P 500 was down, if you summed them, it was 141% in total losses. If you put it in the two fund strategy, the total of the losses was 130%. In other words, it could be said that the two fund strategy, half small cap value, half of the S&P 500, is less risky over time than the S&P 500 and more profitable. And we could look at fund strategy, all US, it did all right as well. Past one. Sorry. This is our website. Nothing for sale. No services. By the way, and you don't get anything in terms of services like personal advice. What you get is a lot of articles, 700 articles and podcasts and 100 videos. All built to try to educate people to be productive on their own. I sat next to somebody at a dinner recently that has made himself a multimillionaire in this industry, and I talked to him about the people who are do-it-yourself investors, and he said, we don't even talk to them. We're never going to convert them into people willing to pay, by the way, this company charged people 1.5 to 2% a year, not one. And so, you know, we want to help the people who just can't even think they'd want to pay somebody $5 million in a lifetime in order to help them do something they can do on their own. Now I can go to that last slide and say thank you. And by the way, again, you can sign up for our newsletter and you can get a free copy of We're Talking Millions. In fact, we have a free audio book of We're Talking Millions for people who are interested. And I have not looked to see if we've had any questions.
We did have a few questions. If you would like to address those now.
I'm happy to stick around and answer them. You bet.
Wonderful. I will note to people, first of all, I put a link to your website, Paul, in the chat for people. So you just need to click that and you can go see that. There's also the sign up link on the screen right now, actually, in the slides. You can click there and go there. I believe it's also in the materials, so you have access to that. I've also put the evaluation link in the chat. So for those of us with tight schedules, if you really have to get going right now, please take a moment to let us know what you thought with the evaluation.
Thank you.
Now, I'll also note for CPE purposes, if you saw the buttons, we're done with the buttons at this point. We're past the time when they'll play. So if you saw and clicked those, you're good. We manually checked that. So it'll be a few days till you see your certificate, but should be coming out then. Now, with all that said, the first question I saw was... let me scroll up and get to it. One question was, are you getting at a self-directed 401k? And I think this was earlier on in terms of like, what are your thoughts on a self-directed 401k?
Well, that's a great question because the self-directed 401k normally means that the company offers a handful of choices, oftentimes terrible choices, by the way, but they also give you a right to go to maybe Fidelity or Schwab or even Vanguard and self-direct and that you can pick the mutual funds or whatever investments that you want. Now, we actually provide people with our recommendations on our website. We have, if you're an ETF investor, we have what we call our best-in-class ETF recommendations. If you said, no, I only want Vanguard ETFs, all right, we have ETFs only that are Vanguard. But these best-in-class ETFs are available at Vanguard and Fidelity and Schwab. And the idea is that they are the best that we're able to find in each of the different asset classes. But yes, now what you have to be careful is some plans have real high expenses to self-direct. So if that is the case, you may only want to do it once a year, and you may only want to go into one fund at a time, or you know, figure out how to minimize the expenses you're going to have to pay inside of that self-directed portfolio.
Great. Another question. This one's a bit longer, so bear with me.
Okay.
This member asks, I took a workshop on annuities and fixed payments for life through Thrivent. I might be mispronouncing that title, but Thrivent. He made an interesting point, I thought, where during the distribution or retirement phase, dollar cost averaging is in reverse and works against the investor, as when the market is in decline, it takes more shares sold to maintain the same income stream. Therefore, he was advocating fixed income annuities in retirement. What are your thoughts on that, Paul?
Well, first of all, I am shocked that an annuity salesperson would recommend annuities. It's like my friends who are in the gold industry. They always have a reason to buy gold. Well, look, the way my wife and I do it, we have a balanced portfolio. And what you do is you're going to sell that's been performing the best to provide you the income for the following year. So in that case, it doesn't mean that you have to do this kind of in reverse. In fact, to the extent that the market's down, you would probably normally be taking money out of fixed income. Now, as most of us know, actually all of us know, fixed income has not been a safe place to be this year, but we happen to recommend only short to intermediate fixed income anyhow. So the typical situation is that you're taking it out of the most productive asset class. Now, having said that, let me tell you what people who want to be very conservative can do. You can have a portfolio where you have 2 years, you're starting the year, we're almost there, January. You have 2 years worth of your money in very short-term instruments. And it's going to meet your cost of living. And you're going to be taking it monthly. Now, my wife and I, we take our money the first day of each year. So we don't care what the market does during the year because we're not taking money out during the year. Now, obviously, at the start of the next year, we care where it is. But the bottom line is that when you get down at the end of the first year taking money out of that two-year pool, you bring another year's worth of money over into that now again two-year pool. So you always have that extra year of extra cash available if you get into a terrible bear market. Now, some people use the bucket strategy. I personally have, when I was an advisor, my clients, if they followed my advice, they would use a total return. We would have, most of my accounts were 50% equity or 60% equity if they were in retirement. Some were 40% equity. But we took the money out of the entire portfolio in order to try to maintain, again, taking out of the most profitable first. To try to protect them from getting behind the eight ball and taking money from a place where they don't want to take it at this point.
Great.
Having said, remember, what's important here is that what that annuity salesperson is suggesting means there's a point, a set of circumstances where you're guaranteed. And for a lot of people, that guarantee is a really, really big deal. And so it's not a bad thing to do. What is a bad thing to do is to pay and get less than you should. So let me recommend for any of you who want to understand annuities to begin with, go to StanTheManAnnuity.com. StanTheManAnnuity.com. And he has more educational information than anybody I know. Plus, you can go on his site, you can put in the very things that any annuity salesman is going to want, and he will give you the quote from the best source of the annuity payout that he knows at that point. And he selects from hundreds. Many people who sell annuities have an annuity to sell, and you're not likely to get the best price if you got only one. I mean, sometimes you'll be the best price, except sometimes the people they're selling for have the largest commissions. And so it's hard to have the best payout when you pay the highest commissions. And I'm not saying Thrivent is high or low. I don't actually remember. But there's a smart way to buy annuities, and there's a costly way, just like overpaying for the expense. By the way, as Bogle would say, the expenses you pay in a mutual fund go on forever. In an annuity, it's the same thing. If you pay too much in expenses, those higher expenses cost you forever.
Great point. Very important. Yeah. And thank you to the member who put standthemanannuity.com in the chat so we can copy and paste that if needed. All right. That's it for questions. Paul, do you have anything you'd like to leave us with before I take us away to the evaluation?
Absolutely. My job is to try to help people do better, their families do better. Our work covers all the way from the time a child is born until you passed on and what did you do for others. I'm talking about as an investor, not talking about all that other stuff that you likely get into, like taxes. And so anytime that we can help you help others, we want to do it. So if somebody asks me for a favor, I may not be able to give you personal advice, but if it means somehow helping you get to a better source of information than you have, I will do all I can to help you do that. That is not illegal for me to do. So go to our website, check us out. Hopefully you will trust us as a good source of following the math for you. Thank you. Really appreciate you coming out today.